This is The Takeaway for Tuesday, January 17th, 2017. And if you like this podcast, don't forget to subscribe to us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks so much for listening. The confirmation hearings continue today in Washington, D.C. Nominee for Secretary of the Interior, Ryan Zinke, a Republican congressman from Montana and former Navy SEAL, will be on Capitol Hill, but he's not expected to face much, if any, opposition. But Betsy DeVos, on the other hand, the nominee for Secretary of Education, is a different story.
All the parents want is greater choice for their children. The more choices we have, the more competition we have, but also the better product or the better learning opportunity for the kids.
You might say Secretary of Education nominee Betsy DeVos, speaking there on Fox News in 2014, has arrived. As a member of the founding families to the Amway fortune in Michigan, the DeVos and Van Andel names were unknown to the Republican establishment of Gerald Ford, who ruled Western Michigan until Ford became president after Nixon resigned over the Watergate scandal. But gradually, the Amway wealth grew, and the DeVos name and money and brand of social conservatism pushed out the old guard of Gerald Ford moderates, and today Betsy DeVos and her husband are billionaire philanthropists who have donated millions to the Republican National Committee and to the campaigns of more than a dozen lawmakers who will vote on whether or not to confirm her as Secretary of Education. DeVos's hearing was actually postponed while the Office of Government Ethics reviewed her financial background. But the question is Betsy DeVos ready to take the national stage? Dr. James Gunner, president and chief executive of the National Charter Schools Institute based in Mount Pleasant, Michigan, has worked with Betsy DeVos for over 20 years. And he says, absolutely yes.
She's got a bold vision for kids, and I think it's going to be great for our country.
Has she been an adversary to the organized teachers' unions and other institutions in education in Michigan?
Well, they're certainly not a fan of hers, but she stands for the students. She stands for the parents. She believes in empowering them with information so that they can choose the best school for their child. And that does cause some enemies from time to time.
Now, does the charter school movement represent a solution nationally, or is it the kind of thing that really will only work in pockets of communities and that the broad population of students remains in a public school setting?
Well, the great thing about charter schools is they are public schools. There's millions of students that are attending them by choice. The vast majority of charter schools are serving students in urban areas, but they also are serving them in rural. They're serving them in back-to-basics approaches to high-tech, to innovative personalized learning. That's the great thing about the charter school idea. Is it's not a one-size-fits-all solution. It's a strategy that's in motion and is adapting to the needs of students.
Do you think she is an eventual advocate of vouchers for all parents and all families in America?
Well, she's certainly been an advocate for vouchers. She believes that parents should have the right to pick which schools best fit for their kid. Now, that's a big question on a national basis. In Michigan, for example, we've got a constitutional amendment that prohibits vouchers, but she stands by her fundamental beliefs, which are choices for parents and students and teachers are a good thing. And I think that's one of the things that are really going to surprise people. She is going to be a champion for teachers, teachers that want to be professionals, teachers that want to be recognized for their talents. They're going to find a champion in Betsy DeVos.
Does she want this job?
I think this is one of those jobs that when you're where Betsy DeVos is, it's a job you don't have to take. But you want to take it because she is dedicated to giving both her time, her talent, and her treasure. And I think she sees this as a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to make a big difference for our kids and our country.
How does it complicate her confirmation hearing? Do you think that she's a contributor to so many of the Senate campaigns of the individuals who will be voting on her confirmation?
Well, that's what the process is about, and there's all the disclosures that have to be filled, and somebody with her experience in travel and financial giving is certainly going to cause people to do some work up front. But I think what they're going to find is you've got somebody who puts her money where her mouth is and that she's been for kids.
And Betsy DeVos has children. Is that right?
She does. And grandchildren.
And did they attend public schools or private schools?
They were in private schools. And I think one of the things that you'll see is that while she's had that opportunity, she believes that if that's the choice other parents want to make, they should have that opportunity as well. But the great thing about America is that it's a system of choice, and there's not a one-size-fits-all approach. And I think that's what you're going to find in Betsy, is somebody that is going to embrace the American idea, and she's going to let parents choose what's the best fit for their kids.
Dr. James Gunner is president and chief executive of the National Charter Schools Institute, based in Mount Pleasant, Michigan. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Is the Betsy DeVos mission to invest in charter schools as part of a national education policy a significant departure from the policies of the Obama years? Is she likely to want to return to some of the changes enacted under the George W. Bush administration? We go now to Diane Ravitch, who is a research professor and historian of education at NYU and former assistant secretary of education under President George H.W. Bush. Diane, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
What do you think is going on here? Is Betsy DeVos, in your view, an ideologue, someone who wants to improve charter schools? There were certainly charter schools under the Obama administration.
Well, let me just be clear that there are, of all the children in this country, about 85% of them are in public schools. 10% have always gone to either private or religious schools, and they're about 6% in charter schools. So she's a champion for the 6%. She's also a dedicated enemy of public schools. She doesn't like public schools. She uses her vast fortune, which is somewhere north of $5 billion, to underwrite the campaigns of people who are in favor of vouchers and charters. And charters, by the way, are not public schools. They're privately managed schools that get public money. And they have, on the whole, not been better than public schools. Detroit is now overrun with charter schools thanks to the DeVos money and its influence over the legislature. And Detroit is the single lowest performing urban district in the country.
So is it, excessively paranoid or conspiratorial to think that this is the culmination of a lifelong mission to really take the national stage and enact these changes from coast to coast?
Well, I can't say it's a lifelong mission, but certainly Betsy DeVos and her husband Dick DeVos, who own the Amway Corporation, have spent many years working towards vouchers. They sponsored a referendum in Michigan in the year 2000 to change the state constitution to allow vouchers, and it went down to a resounding defeat, 69-31. They have promoted vouchers. She has had an organization called the American Federation for Children, which is devoted solely to vouchers and charters and opposed to public education. She is the most dangerous anti-public education person ever nominated to be Secretary of Education.
How can you be anti-public education? I mean, it's such a huge investment. You can't dump public education. I mean, she's only talking about 6% of students in charter schools.
It's 6% now, but she would like to see, her vision is for all children either to be in a religious school with money paid by the public or in a charter school with private management with no accountability and no regulation. That's exactly what's happened in Michigan. And I might add that over the past 15 years, Michigan has gone from being in the middle of the pack on national tests to near the bottom of the pack under these choice policies.
What does it mean that her children went to private schools?
Well, you have to understand that she has no experience in public education whatever. She went to religious schools. Her children went to religious schools. She's never been a teacher or an administrator or a volunteer. She's never done anything that relates to public schools. She is she's an evangelical, essentially, but an evangelical with $5 billion and a great interest in eliminating public education.
But is her idea of choice wrong? I mean, from her perspective, I chose to send my kids to these schools. I had the financial wherewithal to do that. That's choice. Why can't everybody have that choice?
Because it's a great fraud. The reality is that there will never be enough public money to send your children to the school that Betsy DeVos sent her children to. You will get, under her ideas, and all of the public voucher schemes are so small. They're like $5,000, $6,000, $7,000, so that what has happened in states that do have vouchers is that the results are very bad. There has never been a voucher study that shows that kids in voucher schools outperform kids in public schools. The charter schools do not, on the whole, outperform public schools. And there is no high-performing nation in the world that has this free market approach to its education program. So it's a failed idea, and the whole goal here is that of a free market ideologue and a religious zealot, and that's to weaken public schools, because every dollar that goes to a charter school, every dollar that goes to a religious school and a voucher, that comes right out of the public education budget. There is no increase in funding for charters and vouchers. It is a method of disabling and crippling public education.
You expect her to get confirmed?
Well, considering that 10 of the 12 Republican senators who will be considering her nomination have received DeVos funding, I would expect she will be confirmed. I've been fighting against it because I think she's going to be a disaster for our public schools, which have been always a very fundamental part of this democracy, is that public schools are open to everyone. I mean, in the nature of school choice, the schools choose. They don't take the kids with disabilities. They don't take the kids who are English language learners. They take the kids they want to take. In public education, the school is responsible, or the school system is responsible, to educate every single child who applies, regardless of whether or not they speak English, regardless of their handicap. She has also, by the way, given money to Mitch McConnell. It's hard to find a Republican senator she has not given money to. I don't think she was doing this in order to get confirmed. It was really in order to strengthen her hold on the Republican Party, but to strengthen her as a national voice for eliminating and destroying and weakening public education.
Diane Ravitch is research professor of education at NYU and historian of education, former assistant secretary of education in the President George H.W. Bush administration. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
What's your preference in education? Charter schools, voucher programs, public schools? On Facebook, Chris writes, the kids currently attending a neighborhood charter school, luck by way of a lottery drawing, and so far so good. Biggest difficulty holding on to quality teachers, as charter school teachers' income seem to be lower than that of regular school teachers.
My name is Jessica Epstein from Tucson, Arizona. I think public schools should be the first priority because the majority of people rely on local schools accessible by bus in their neighborhood.
My name is Jill, and I'm calling from Jamestown, Rhode Island. I'm not sure whether the debate should be between charter schools or public schools, but I do think that we need to restructure our school system. High school seems to be a bit of a waste, regardless of which side you're on. I think we need to focus our restructuring on applied programming and technical skills. It would be great if we could provide real jobs for people leaving high school.
Provo, Utah. I think charter schools are a great mix of public school accessibility and homeschooling customization and quality. It allows people to choose what quality they want to focus on for their children. Nyack, New York. America's top priority should be improving education from birth to age 5. This has been shown to produce the best bang for the buck. Studies have shown that high-quality preschools can increase a person's earning capacity later in life. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Or comment on our Facebook page. In the impending Affordable Care Act showdown, it's the big numbers we hear most often.
We are saying to our Republican colleagues, we will not allow you to throw up to 30 million Americans off of health insurance.
30 million Americans, says Bernie Sanders at a Michigan rally to try and preserve the health care law. He's a relatively lonely voice in a Republican Congress bent on repeal. And this country is about to find out how complicated the ACA actually is and what sorts of things could go away. Lawmakers are apparently getting a hint of this complexity. President-elect Trump says a replacement insurance for everybody plan will be implemented right away, but there are no experienced voices on Capitol Hill who believe that can happen. Mary Agnes Carey is senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News and tells us what to watch for as the Obamacare Disappearing Act begins. Mary, what could happen? What could vanish before our eyes here that maybe we aren't expecting?
Well, there are several provisions of the Affordable Care Act that people might not link to the Affordable Care Act, things like direct access to an OBGYN for women, a shelter from some surprise medical costs for emergency room visits. Even some of these calorie counts that you're seeing now on menus, people don't necessarily link these to the Affordable Care Act, but there are a variety of provisions in the Affordable Care Act that people may not know that they could lose.
Well, let's talk about the emergency room visits. How does the Affordable Care Act control emergency room visit costs?
Let's say you have to go to an ER in a hospital that's not in your network. What the Affordable Care Act does is says that that hospital can't charge you other co-payments or co-insurance because you're not in the network. So that has to be the same, equal payments. But the thing that people do have to remember is if you're out of network, your health insurance plan may not pay that hospital as generously as if it were in your network. So that hospital could still balance bill for the out-of-pocket costs not covered by your health insurer.
What does direct access to OBGYN care mean?
It means you don't have to call your primary care doctor and say, would you please write me a referral so I can go see my OBGYN? That direct access for women means they can go directly to the OBGYN. And this is important because a lot of women may not have that primary care physician, or they may prefer to go to their OBGYN for all sorts of primary care services.
And this relates to breast pumping, to nursing?
Well, for breastfeeding now, what has to happen is employers have to provide women break time to express milk for up to a year after giving birth and provide a place, not necessarily absolutely not the bathroom stall. That's where a lot of women have been stuck over the years with their breast pumps. Employers now have to provide a different, you know, a room that allows you to have the privacy to express your milk. And also, as we're talking about breast pumps, many breast pumps are now covered under your insurance with the Affordable Care Act.
And the ACA stipulates all of that, from the employer accommodations all the way to the access to breast pumps.
Right. They really are trying to change a lot of aspects about healthcare. For example, we know about the subsidies that help people provide coverage. We've heard about the exchanges where you can pick the menu of plans, but the law is sweeping and comprehensive. And these are some of the things that come into play when you're talking about a repeal. This is all really up in the air right now.
Up in the air, meaning that for instance, a restaurant, it's up to them to decide whether they've removed the calorie counts from their menu. And it's up to an employer to decide whether they roll back the accommodations that they've already made. They're not compelled to do so, but if the ACA goes away, they're under no obligation to maintain any of that.
That's right. The calorie count provision you mentioned refers to chain restaurants, fast food chains with at least 20 stores. Some had done this voluntarily before the Affordable Care Act, but now that is implemented to be part of what restaurants do. So that's exactly right.
What about chronic care therapies, physical therapy, occupational therapy, and the like?
Well, here's what's interesting, and here's the twist in the ACA that a lot of people don't know. As you mentioned, for example, if you had an injury where you lost use of your shoulder, maybe you went skiing, you broke your shoulder, insurers have before and have continued to cover things like physical therapy to help you regain the movement of that shoulder. What's new in the ACA to help people with degenerative diseases is providing services to help them get functions they never had. For example, maybe speech therapy for a child who never learned how to talk. These are habilitative care services. They're part of the essential health benefits that are sold in plans that are sold to individuals and in small group plans. And this is a brand new part of the Affordable Care Act and the essential health benefits that wasn't necessarily there with a lot of insurance plans before.
Lawmakers could, in fact, you know, develop some sort of replacement plan that includes some of these and omits others.
Well, see, that's a great question to ask, because what happens now is going forward, there's a process called reconciliation where they repeal the revenue provisions. But separately, as Republicans move forward to try to replace the Affordable Care Act, in the Senate, they're going to need Democratic support because they don't have enough votes to stop a filibuster. That takes 60 votes in the Senate. So Republicans will be reaching out to Democrats to say, we want to make these changes. Are you on board? Can we make tweaks we can all agree with? Not quite sure what the Republicans will do or where the Democrats will come out, but that's the next phase of this debate.
If ACA goes away tomorrow, it actually represents a fairly sizable tax cut for the very rich.
Right, it does. There are a couple provisions in the law that raise taxes on individuals who make more than $200,000 a year and couples who make more than $250,000. That has been put in to help finance the law.
Any way to assess what the dollar amount of these tax savings is likely to be for these high-income earners?
In total, the estimated annual tax cut is $7 million if these two taxes were repealed. And that's almost $3 billion yearly loss in tax revenues to the Treasury.
Mary Agnes Carey is partnerships editor and senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. She spoke to us from Washington, D.C. Thanks, Mary.
Thank you.
Pretty interesting legal debate in the Supreme Court today. Oral arguments on an immigration case, Lynch versus DiMaia. Originally from the Philippines, James Garcia DiMaia has been living in the United States as a lawful permanent resident since 1992. But DiMaia was convicted of first-degree residential burglary in 2007 and 2009. This is technically a crime of violence under immigration law and grounds for mandatory deportation as an aggravated felony. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals decided that the crime of violence test was unconstitutionally vague. We go down to Deep Dulasekaram, law professor at Santa Clara University. Deep, welcome to The Takeaway.
Good to be with you.
What are the criteria for deportation, and how are they governed by constitutional criteria?
So Congress has laid out many, many categories for deportation. One of those criteria is what's known as an aggravated felony. In general, Congress's criteria for removal are not actually subject to significant constitutional restrictions. One of the reasons why cases that present whether any of those grounds is constitutional or not are unique and important.
I think most Americans would just view immigration as a condition that is utterly at the whim of the government of the United States, and that if someone does anything, they can be deported. And they would not have the same kinds of protections as an American citizen would.
Sure. Certainly the beginnings of immigration law and federal immigration law in the late 1800s took views similar to the one that you're articulating. But what's happened over the last years is people have understood and courts have understood that people who are here under all sorts of immigrant laws, whether they're documented or not, have ties to the United States, end up having accumulating rights to be in the United States, or at least rights to have fair process when they're being asked to leave the United States. And that's part of these cases that are coming in before the Supreme Court.
Talk about this particular case, James Garcia DiMaia.
Sure. So as I mentioned before, one of the categories that Congress uses to remove people and then the federal executive then charges is this category of aggravated felon. It's a term of art, meaning it's defined in the immigration statute. And one of the many things that count as an aggravated felony is a category called a crime of violence, which a federal law defines as a felony that by its nature involves a substantial risk that physical force against person or property will be used. DiMaia was convicted under a California burglary statute. And the question in this case is whether burglary under California law counts as a crime of violence. And the reason this is important is if one is convicted of an aggravated felony according to the immigration law, it makes a person ineligible for lots of types of relief from removal, including cancellation of removal. It bars somebody from reentering the country ever. And if one does return, it greatly enhances the punishment. And what Mr. DiMaia is arguing here, and an argument that was accepted by the appeals court, the federal appeals court, is that the crime of violence definition is simply too vague, that it violates the Fifth Amendment to the Constitution's guarantee of due process because it doesn't give sufficient notice of what conduct is actually illegal.
Now, does this apply to undocumented immigrants or to only people who are naturalized citizens?
Well, in this case, certainly Mr. DiMaia he's a legal permanent resident of the United States. In fact, he's a very long-term legal permanent of the resident of the United States, having entered in 1992. But the substantive ground of deportation as written in the immigration statute applies to undocumented immigrants, lawfully present immigrants who've been here for a very long time. There's a set of cases that have asked this question of the court, and here you have an opportunity for the Supreme Court to say very clearly that the void for vagueness doctrine, a due process doctrine grounded in the Fifth Amendment, applies in the immigration setting.
Deep Gulasekaram is a law professor at Santa Clara University. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
The United Kingdom is leaving the European Union, and my job is to get the right deal for Britain as we do.
Ah, yes, we return to the Brexit drama. Suddenly, it has all the twists and turns of a Dickens novel. That's British Prime Minister Theresa May trying to sound more clear about a policy she seemed to endorse, leaving the EU. But then she got all cagey, telling the British people it all depended on article this or paragraph that nothing immediate could happen. Markets were not pleased. Now, whatever deal emerges must go to a vote of both houses of parliament before it comes into force. The British pound rallied on that news after hitting a 30-year low on Monday. President-elect Trump praised Britain as smart for voting to leave and predicted that other European nations would follow suit in a conversation with Member of Parliament Michael Gove. Robin Wigglesworth is U.S. Markets Editor for the Financial Times and joins me now. You really need a Rosetta Stone for this one, huh?
Yes, I wish it was as enjoyable and as clear as a Dickensian novel, but unfortunately it's not.
So what do we know? I mean, what's happening here? The parliamentary referendum or the parliamentary vote actually sets things back, doesn't it?
Well, the two main takeaways from this speech was that people have wanted her to give a bit more clarity for some time, and we did get some more. The main thing is we're going to have what people call a hard Brexit. So there's not going to be some sort of halfway house where they go into a sort of arrangement like Norway or Switzerland or Liechtenstein has. They're going to go a clean break, so completely out of the European Union, and then they're going to try and negotiate some sort of association, some sort of trade agreement with the Europeans to make sure there isn't, you know, a complete economic Armageddon.
Do you think it's possible that, I mean, you know, President-elect Trump is so enthusiastic about Brexit and claimed actually credit for the whole thing at that golf course in Scotland, yes. I remember the day after the vote. Is it possible that he has already made a deal with May that there will be a bilateral arrangement that will soften the blow here and that she knows that going forward?
Well, he certainly communicated so to Michael Gove, who was a leadership rival of Mrs. May, but still sits in Parliament on the Conservative Party, whether that actually happens. I mean, we all know it's very easy to say, yes, yes, great new deal, we'll make an amazing deal. And then, you know, trade agreements take years and years and years to negotiate. And it's not just about, you know, I'll sell you a widget and you sell me your widgets. It's about tariffs. It's about regulations. There's lots of services. It's just a very convoluted situation.
Looking around Europe and other countries, of course, are considering the same kind of move. Based on what's happened just in the month since the Brexit vote, do you think countries are inclined to go down this road or maybe, yikes, stay away from it?
Well, we'll see. I mean, clearly the European Union is 27 countries and they're not all united on how they should approach Britain. There is an element of they don't want to cut off their nose despite their face. But on the other hand, they have a political incentive to make this as tough on Britain as possible because they want to keep their primary goal is to keep that club together. And giving the UK sweetheart deal is not going to help them on that.
How's the Prime Minister, Theresa May's support in the Tories and in the Parliament?
That's pretty strong. I mean, she's got a comfortable majority. She's not elected. She hasn't won an election herself, but she's got a comfortable majority, and the opposition parties are generally in shambles. So the main opposition comes from inside her own party, these hardline Brexiteers and the slightly more reluctant Remainers that maybe would have preferred the UK to have some sort of halfway house deal.
So May is solid and the Brexit drama stumbles forward. Right?
Yes, we'll just have to see what happens. She'll put the final deal to Parliament. If that comes before and after an election, that might change the outlook. But for now, she's still sitting pretty.
Robin Wigglesworth, U.S. Markets Editor for the Financial Times. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
During the 2016 campaign, Donald Trump became a lightning rod for oppressive gender roles, the reports of improper sexual advances, of Trump's alleged behavior in the workplace, and distasteful comments about touching women's bodies, judging women by their physical appearance. All of this turned the campaign into something of a referendum on women's rights. In the end, though, Hillary Clinton lost a sizable chunk of mostly white women voters. But this weekend, women and men across the country will march in Washington, D.C. and elsewhere in an event to say that gender issues are still very much in play.
These prejudices, these hateful beliefs that people have, or really it's the discomfort, I think, with viewing women as potentially equal or potentially just as complicated, diverse, nuanced as males.
Julie Chelfo is author of the book The Women Who Made New York. Julie says it's time to end thinking of women as an afterthought. At this week's marches, the ghosts of all the outspoken and unforgettable characters Chelfo learned about will be present in spirit, she says.
I was absolutely stunned to learn about this woman, Hetty Green, who was known as the Witch of Wall Street. And it was such a terrible name, you know, the Witch of Wall Street. And she was in the Guinness Book of World Records for being the world's largest miser. But when you dig a little deeper, and there's some wonderful biographies about her available, you learn that she was should have been called the Oracle of Wall Street because she was so phenomenally astute at maneuvering the markets. And in part, it was because from the time she was 6 years old, her father, who was an investor, had insisted that she read the morning papers to him. And she used to read commodities reports and all these things. So by the time her father passed away and she inherited a small amount of money, I think it was $1 million, she began investing it. And by the time of her death, was one of the richest people in the world. And so she operated on Wall Street, but the men couldn't stand her. She was so successful. She was very miserly, it's true, and she didn't really spend a lot of money on new clothing. She had a perfectly good, you know, black dress that she started wearing after her husband died. She also wore a black veil. And she just didn't think it was worth it to buy new clothes every, you know, couple months for the new fashion, which was very popular in the Gilded Age. So they called her the Witch of Wall Street, yet when New York City had financial troubles, they turned to her, and she became a personal loan agent to New York City and bailed the city out repeatedly. And also when there was the big panic of 1909, she was one of the people they turned to for assistance.
Let's talk about Broadway, women who made Broadway. Is it on stage or off stage?
Well, you know, that's a great question, and I was able to get in touch with a lot of scholars who just study Broadway and write about Broadway. And, you know, there was no good way to answer this question because there are so many phenomenal women in the history of Broadway. But Betty Comden is in the book. She's a lyricist.
Sure.
And, you know, she wrote New York, New York. It's a hell of a town. So, you know, we had to include her. And I put Fanny Brice in there because she was so pioneering in sort of bringing humor to Broadway. And also, she was the one who helped take what was happening in the Follies and sort of before Broadway and make it sort of part of the core of what we think about as musical theater on Broadway. And then another person in the book, which I think will be unexpected to many people, Ethel Waters, who most of us think of as a singer and think about her music and her voice more than her Broadway performances. But she was so successful on Broadway that at one time she was believed to be the highest paid actor of any gender. So when women were still not really getting parity on Broadway, she was very well paid. She just commanded the respective audiences like you wouldn't believe. And without her, I think it would have been even longer till we saw any kind of integration or equality.
Well, gender or race.
Exactly.
Integration, that's for sure. What you take away from this book going, I bet you never knew, because there's at least two dozen I bet you never knew names in this book.
It's impossible for me to pick a favorite, but I did kind of fall in love with this woman, Sarah Josephine Baker, who's not the singer Josephine Baker, but she was one of the first women to become a physician in the United States, and she was able to attend medical school thanks to another woman in the book who was the first female doctor in the U.S. And she was interested in public health, and she worked at the turn of from the 19th to the 20th century at the city's public health department, and she had a low-level job, so they would send her out to do whatever sort of, you know, junk work that nobody else wanted to do. And the tenements were just a teeming mess at this point. And a lot of her male colleagues wouldn't even go into them. They thought it was disgusting. And she dressed like a man because she didn't want to sort of stand out. And she rolled up her sleeve, she put on her muck boots, and she went into the tenements to figure out how disease was spreading. And it became abundantly clear to her that there wasn't basic sanitation. People couldn't wash their hands after they changed a diaper, or they didn't even have diapers. And she began to set up a number of practices that ultimately dropped the infant mortality rate in the city by more than 50%. She created programs that called Little Mothers Guilds, where nurses would go in and teach 7 and 8 year old girls who were the ones caring for children in the city when their mothers were out at work, because poor women had to work to try and feed their families. One thing that could never happen today, but when she was trying to get people in Lower Manhattan vaccinated for smallpox, they couldn't get the men on the Bowery to come in. And so she devised this plan where she met with her staff at midnight, and a police officer accompanied them, and she brought the vaccines to them. So at like 2-3 o'clock in the morning, these guys were sort of passed out, and she would just vaccinate them, and they would wake
up.
That's
incredible.
Isn't that incredible? But she succeeded in getting rid of smallpox in the city. So it was. She's an enormously impressive person, and I sure wish I had known more about her growing up.
Not a pioneer, but the pioneer of public health in New York City.
She is, and Elizabeth Milbank Anderson is another one in the book, and she is another wealthy woman who inherited all kinds of money from her family. And rather than, build a monument to herself and put her name on it. You won't see her name anywhere in the city. Every project she did is with the Milbank family name. But she gave her money to Barnard and actually purchased the campus that belongs to Barnard College today. But she also spent money and opened one of the first public bathhouses in the city. She had lost her son when he was very young to disease. And she said, she got in touch with public health folks and she said, what can I do to really help? And they said, people need a place to shower. They need a place to do their laundry. And so she built one.
Julie Shelfo is a journalist and author of The Women Who Made New York. Thanks, Julie.
Thanks so much. It was a lot of fun to work on.
I object to those stories that say I'm a lame duck. I'm not a lame duck. I'm a sprinting duck.
Well, it's hard to remember back to the days of the George W. Bush administration. The lack of U.S. credibility in world affairs was so evident, the president himself even occasionally joked about it, as he did at the 2006 White House Correspondents' Dinner.
I'm a hustling duck. I'm a leadership of the free world duck. And I'm continuing to spread our agenda globally and around the world, as well as internationally.
When he took office in 2009, President Obama vowed to restore that international credibility. And while his 8-year reputation in international affairs has been one of intelligence and statesmanship, during that same time, the U.S. has also been seen to withdraw from being a driving force in world affairs. Influence in the Middle East has diminished, having had little impact on the wars in Syria or Yemen. Susan Glasser, foreign affairs columnist at Politico, and Steve Clemens, Washington editor-at-large for The Atlantic, agree that the Obama years will be remembered as the start of an unprecedented withdrawal from world affairs. Clemens says in many ways, he did not see this coming.
Barack Obama came in when the stock of American power in the world was perceived to be very low. During the Bush administration, both major economic limits through the subprime crisis and then the invasion of Iraq and the real failure to move the needle in Iraq and Afghanistan began to demonstrate both to allies and foes that American military power was not what it used to be. And so that's what he inherited. And then when you come in and you come into the Middle East, and no matter where you're at, whether you think that every problem in the region is an American one or not, the Middle East, both from a geopolitical perspective but also a kind of theological one in terms of the Arab Muslim world, needs to go through a process. And we are not big enough nor have the scale enough to really influence that. So when you look at the fact when people say nothing happened in the Middle East, it may be that no one had an answer. And I tend to be one of those on the realist side of things that's more cautious about saying that Obama achieved nothing. He began to do things on nuclear safety that were important. And I think he began to prioritize things like the Iran deal to demonstrate that America was not out of the game, that it could strategically order its priorities and relationships to try to move the world, to move Iran. And that, in the long run, shows the world that we're still able to use our power in benevolent and important ways in the global system.
So Barack Obama's insight is that there's really no role for a single superpower. Caution is the better part of valor, and Iran is a good detail, but mostly it's seeing that there's nothing to do that constitutes a victory, Susan?
You know, look, it's hard to say because 10 years from now, 20 years from now, the story may well look very different. But, you know, I think one place where I would disagree with Steve, at least on emphasis, and not necessarily on the facts, but on emphasis, is on this question of where does Barack Obama end his presidency? And my view is that certainly not in the place where he or his advisors would have wanted the conversation to be when it comes to America's role in the world. And they did come in 2008 with a view that they were about restoring America's reputation after what they saw as some of the flaws and failures and criticisms of the Bush era. And you could argue that they were successful in that initial phase, but that we're ending, let's be real, it's not just that Donald Trump is coming in to succeed and potentially to undo many of the things that Barack Obama has done, both internationally as well as domestically, but it's also just on a purely more objective and factual sense, the war in Syria has been an unmitigated disaster. And while Obama has been cautious to the point of even overruling his own advisors repeatedly on doing anything in Syria to stop the bloodshed, that doesn't mean that he won't, you know, potentially spend the rest of his life trying to figure out what he could have and should have done differently. That's been an enormous failure, it seems to me, while on Obama's watch. That doesn't mean that he personally is responsible for it, but it means that the United States, in not acting, allowed a tremendous tragedy to occur. So that's one thing I think will haunt Obama and his legacy in the world going forward. And then just another thought I wanted to throw into the conversation. We are literally having a conversation right now about whether this is the end of the liberal international order and you know, whether Trump and the rise of these other authoritarian populists in Europe represents actually the fraying of this system of international institutions and alliances that has basically secured the world since the very end of World War II. Who knows if that's going to be the case or not, but I think it's extraordinary that this is what we're ending the Obama era with. And I do wonder whether he will be remembered as the last president of that post-war era.
It seems like there are a lot of gestures that could have been made, big global gestures on the refugee crisis. Okay, you can't solve the war in Syria, but could we have had a huge sort of global scope of response to the refugee crisis? We really didn't. What about nuclear proliferation? I mean, he won a Nobel Prize, but nuclear weapons are at about the same place aside from the Iran deal. The Iran deal feels like it was gettable, so he did that. And then if you look at the Middle East, we're not there. And if you really want to, you know, lie awake at night, think about Yemen. That is a famine that the U.S. is enabling through our alliance with Saudi Arabia. Those are all real negatives, if you ask me.
Well, on the first two, I would agree with one and not on the other. I think that with regards to Syria, in which no matter how you cook it, it is a set of civil wars with a set of proxy conflicts on top. It's very, very complex. But I've always been critical of the Obama administration and Congress writ large and our country for not having done something far, far more robust with the human consequences, the refugee crisis, much earlier, far, far before we began seeing photographs of young children washing up on the shores of Greece and other places. I disagree on the nuclear front in the sense that in an elite way, among the strategic class of countries around the world, Barack Obama created a new set of norms and practices that were important to pay attention. Mm. My criticism of it is that no one knows about it.
Right, exactly.
That the younger generation knows nothing about nuclear issues, and it's been somewhat troubling to me that with Donald Trump tweeting about a nuclear arms with Russia, people look at this as a contest you can sort of win. I think the failure of the administration was not one of not moving, but of actually marketing to the next generation how many of these important institutions that were established in the past continue to have vital weight and leverage as we go into the future.
There was a lot of talk about a pivot to Asia. Susan, did we ever get there?
No, I would say no. I mean, that's what's so striking, and the Asia thing is a good example. So I think is the nuclear issue. To me, that's what's so striking about where Obama is ending. Are we talking about a president who's so eloquent, who's so disciplined, who had a very strategic checklist, in effect, of things he wanted to accomplish on the world stage, opening up a dialogue with Iran, which he successfully did, opening up a dialogue with Cuba, which he successfully did. And yet, here we are. He aspired even to embrace the rhetoric of global zero and to work towards eliminating nuclear weapons and cared about it more, arguably, than any president since Ronald Reagan and Bill Clinton in the immediate aftermath of the Cold War. And yet, dot, dot, dot. To me, on all of these issues, that's what we're talking about is, you know, and yet, doesn't it make it all the more poignant? Listen to Barack Obama in his farewell address. He barely even mentioned the world. To the extent he did, he had one sentence sort of saying, hey, yeah, I got that Iran deal and I killed Osama bin Laden. But this is not the farewell address of an eloquent orator who has a lot to brag about.
Well, lots to think about there. Susan Glasser, foreign affairs columnist at Politico, and Steve Clemens, Washington editor at large for The Atlantic. Susan and Steve, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And here's something to take with you today. Humanity is now officially earthbound once again. The last feet to walk on the moon are no more. Former astronaut Gene Cernan has died at age 82. He was the commander of the Apollo 17 lunar landing mission in 1972 and the last human to walk on the moon.
Oh, my golly. Unbelievable. Unbelievable, but is it bright in the sun?
It was the most proud moment of my entire life.
That's Gene Cernan in the Netflix documentary, The Last Man on the Moon. Cernan was a legendary aviator and astronaut. He will be missed. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.